90.5 WKAR and the Thursday edition of Current State. Glad you're along. I'm Mark Bayshore. Coming up this hour, stick around for a glimpse of this weekend's Summer Solstice Jazz Festival in East Lansing. The Broad Art Museum is a part of the event this year with a live musical tribute to jazz icon Sun Ra. You'll be hearing from one of the players who is a part of that tribute coming up in just a little bit. I'm not sure if he's going to indulge in any cosmic philosophy or not. We'll just have to find out. Also later this hour, there's been all kinds of activity. East Lansing's Patriarch Park, Kevin Lavery, yesterday checked out what it was all about, and he will provide an update. The park is changing. So that is coming up, and lots more. We hope you can stick around. The Lansing area is expected to get something of a break from yesterday's stormy weather that triggered watches and warnings. And to review how impactful all the rain was, and for a peek at the extended forecast for the remainder of the summer, we're joined by WILX TV 10 meteorologist Andy Provenzano. Welcome back, senor.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Our tremendous growing season continued yesterday. Between the early morning and the afternoon downpours, how much rain did the Lansing area get?
Yesterday was about an inch and a half at the airport. To go on to the other, it's almost 4 inches. We're well over 5 for the month now.
Amazing.
Come in bunches, that's for sure. And timely rains. I mentioned yesterday, boy, if you wanted to be some sort of vegetation, this was the year to do it.
Absolutely. That has been so noticeable. It's as green, I think, as it's looked in many years. Is the rain returning anytime soon?
We will see rain again tomorrow. Here today, we're going to start to get an easterly breeze, and that will dry us out a little bit, get the sun to pop out here later this afternoon. But that same pattern that had all the heat just to the south, including over us most of the week here, is still going to be around for a couple more days. And what happens is the storms form along the edge of that, and, of course, we're on the edge of it, so they come our way. Sunday and Monday, we missed out, but then we got into it here in the last 24 hours.
I guess so. With the seasons changing Saturday night, Andy, I might as well ask what the models are showing for the rest of the summer.
Well, you know, everybody has a different look at it. I know the Weather Service is calling for a cooler summer and a wetter one. I just think it's going to be normal, very normal summer. We've seen already many 80-degree days for highs. Our highs have been running above normal. Then all of a sudden we'll cool down and have temperatures in the 40s at night and 70 degrees by day, and that kind of averages out. That's probably the pattern here for the summer, having a stretch or two where you end up being slightly cooler, maybe more pleasant, pleasing those folks who like the summer's cool, and then you get a week or two where you're back in the 80s and low 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how they always average the numbers, and by the end of the summer, I think it'll be dead even. And I still think it's a pretty decent summer coming our way.
People who watch the lake and river levels like the rain, too, and I know generally levels are up. What about water temperatures?
Of course, we had that tremendous winter. Very, very cold.
Don't tell me there's still ice in Lake Superior.
No, there's not. There's not. But, you know, there's three main buoys out in the center part of the lake in Lake Superior, and they have two in Lake Michigan, one that's in the northern part of the lake and then one that's in the southern part of the lake. And all of them are reading temperatures that are in the upper 30s. So obviously a lot of cold air, cold water out there. It's not easy to warm up the center of the lake. Notice that it takes a while for that to happen. But on the shorelines, we are starting to see some like temperatures in the low 60s. You get down to Michigan City, also South Haven, Holland, they're all running in the low to mid 60s. And then when you get a warm stretch like this week, it might get up into the upper 60s. So that's a good sign because you got to heat the lake up from the shoreline, and then that makes its way into the center of the lake. Will it run cool all year? Certainly will. And you pointed that out, the amount of moisture we've had, and the rivers are high. The lakes have come way up some 18 inches since a year ago. And it takes a lot longer to try to heat up a lot more water that started out so very, very cold.
Do you think you're calling for an average summer weather-wise. Does that suggest that the lawns might get the lawns and the crops might get dried out and a little crinkly before we're through here?
You know, it's hard not to avoid, you know, some kind of mini drought in the summer. You get the high pressure in the right position. There's always what they call the Bermuda High that forms off the eastern half of our nation, and that happens midsummer, and it can put you in a dry spell for a couple of weeks. But I don't see it being prolonged. We've got timely rains. We're shifting the air masses so much. I mean, they had snow in Glacier National Park yesterday, I think 18 inches of snow. And they were just pushing 100 a couple of weeks ago. So,
oh, good grief.
A lot of fluctuation. So I don't anticipate us being very, very dry, but just like every summer, we always get a stretch where it stays hot and dry for a little while, and then we snap back out of it. I'm more worried about getting into an early fall than I am having a bad summer.
Oh, okay. Well, we've pretty much covered all the bases here. We appreciate it very much. WILX TV 10 meteorologist Andy Provenzano. Have a good day, Andy.
You too.
As the Michigan economy works to recover from the economic downturn and the decline in its manufacturing base, we've been having plenty of debates over what policies to pursue that encourage economic growth and ensure a robust public education system and set Michigan on a long-term path toward more prosperity. With much state policy recently determined by a Republican majority in the state capitol, the path touted to bring Michigan's economy back often involves lower taxes, a decrease in regulation, and an overall reduction in the role of government. But a recent report put out by Michigan Future, an Ann Arbor-based think tank that focuses on the Michigan economy, looks at one state in our region, Minnesota, that has the most robust economy among the Great Lakes states, and yet its residents are some of the most heavily taxed in the nation. Rick Haglund is a longtime Michigan journalist and the author of the report entitled State Policies Matter: How Minnesota's Tax, Spending, and Social Policies Help It Achieve the Best Economy Among Great Lakes States. Rick joins us by phone to help us see what we might learn from Minnesota. Welcome back to the program, Rick.
Good to be with you, Mark.
By what measures does Minnesota have the healthiest economy in the Great Lakes?
Well, by many of them. They have the highest per capita income among the Great Lakes states, the lowest unemployment rate. I believe they have the lowest poverty rate as well. And another important measure that we don't think about a lot is the percentage of adults that are in the workforce. Minnesota has the highest rate in the Great Lakes region and one of the highest in the country. So a lot of people working, low poverty, high incomes.
And as you were digging into the research, what surprised you about Minnesota?
Well, we knew going into this that Minnesota was a high-tax state and spent more on things that Michigan Future would say are important to developing a competitive, knowledge-based economy. I guess we were a little surprised at how much more Minnesota taxes than Michigan does in some of the spending areas. I mean, as an example, they have a progressive personal income tax system. The highest rate, the wealthiest people in the state, people making over $250,000 a year, pay 9.85% income tax rate. Michigan has a flat rate of less than half that, 4.25%. And even the people on the lowest end of the income scale pay 5.35%, which is higher than Michigan's rate. Although there's some circuit breaker type stuff that allows people at the low end of the spectrum to pay less than that 5.35%. But still, in all, very high tax rates. Businesses, the business income tax rate is a third higher than Michigan, and virtually every business has to pay something. Unlike Michigan, where only C corporations are taxed.
Let's look at a few of the key policy differences that you looked at in your paper. Revenue sharing, first of all, huge topic here in Michigan. How does Minnesota handle revenue sharing?
Well, they do it in a couple of ways. They have something that is comparable to our revenue sharing that they call local government aid. which is on a per capita basis roughly about what we spend, maybe even a little less. But there's a whole variety of other aid that they give for specific local government services such as police and fire. That was $2 billion last year. So on a per capita basis, overall, they're spending about four times as much in local aid to local communities as we do.
Mm. How do they fund their roads?
They fund their roads with three different taxes. They have a gasoline tax, like we have in Michigan, that's 9 cents a gallon higher than our tax. They also have a sales, they apply the sales tax to gasoline sales, but unlike in Michigan, all of that money goes to
roads
and public transportation. In Michigan, it goes to the general fund and schools. And their third source of revenue is their motor vehicle registration tax, which also goes, is dedicated to transportation. So on transportation, they're spending more than double per capita than we are.
So a bigger bite at the gas pump in Minnesota?
Yes. I was going to check this morning to see how retail gas prices compare to Minnesota to Michigan. I didn't get a chance to do that, but the gasoline tax is a little over 9 cents a gallon higher than ours.
Let's look at taxes here a little bit, too. Minnesota recently raised its income tax rate on the wealthy and its business tax rate, as I think you have alluded to here earlier. Has that led to businesses leaving the state, the business tax bit?
Not that we could determine. In fact, we got an email the other day after the report came out from an official in the state of Minnesota saying that basically business formation has been increasing in the state. The latest Fortune 500 report showed that Fortune 500 companies had been growing. The number had been growing in Minnesota over the past 15 years. Some of the data that's available is really really lags, and we didn't really look into whether businesses were leaving or not. But that was some of the evidence that we've seen.
Well, as objectively as possible here, Rick, how much food for thought does your study provide for the Republican majority at the Michigan Capitol?
Well, I think what's happened in Michigan is we've had sort of a one-sided debate as to how to enact policies that aid the economy, and basically that has been cut taxes, lower regulation, mm-hmm. shrink the size of government, do right to work, and those sorts of things. There really hasn't been much of a counterpoint saying, hey, here's some examples where maybe this, it's more effective to do something else. And if you look at the history of tax cuts in Michigan, we bounce back periodically with when the auto industry comes back, but basically these tax cuts over a long period of time have not really increased Michigan's prosperity. And in fact, if you look at things like per capita income, how we rank against other states, we've lost significant ground over the past 20 or 30 years, where Minnesota has basically been one of the strongest economies for the past 40 years in virtually every year.
Rick Haglund is our guest from Bridge Magazine. Rick's just wrapped up a report that appears in Bridge entitled State Policies Matter, How Minnesota's Tax Spending and Social Policies Help It Achieve the Best Economy Among Great Lakes States. Could you argue that Michigan or that Minnesota's economy, I mean, you mentioned 3M, General Mills, Honeywell, Target, a number of others. Could you argue that Minnesota enjoys the kind of diversified economy that Michigan is really trying to create?
Certainly. In fact, we say that in the report that obviously a lot of this is due to the mix of industries in Minnesota. There's no question about that. Underlying that are these state policies that people in Minnesota, by and large, think are important to the prosperity of their state.
Yeah, talk to us about that.
Well, it really goes back really a long way. Some of this is really cultural. Michigan and Minnesota are kind of similar states. Certainly, they're both cold weather states, upper Midwest, they border the Great Lakes, and all of that. But what seems to be the case in Minnesota is that there's maybe more of a balance of looking out for the community good as well as the individual good. In fact, one of the people I talked to there when I was doing the research told me this little joke that Minnesotans are very civic-minded people. They pay some of the highest taxes of any state in the country, and they give what's left over to Minnesota Public Radio.
Oh, that's good.
So there really is a history of civic-mindedness there. One of the other things that's kind of interesting is a lot of states basically take the approach of, well, in order to get more people into the workforce and get people off welfare and unemployment, we've got to shrink those benefits and give people more of an incentive to work. Minnesota does exactly the opposite, which is really interesting. They've got very high spending on health and human services. Their maximum weekly benefit for unemployment is $610 a week, one of the highest in the country, maybe the highest in the country. Michigan is $362 a week. So, I mean, and yet they've got an unemployment rate of 4.7%. So it really tells you something kind of interesting.
Not everything is going well in Minnesota. I mean, the Minneapolis school district has been struggling for a number of years. It has one of the worst graduation rates for African American males in the country. How do you parse out what policies are responsible for the success in Minnesota and which ones are still perhaps not effective in areas like public education?
Well, you're right, and I don't know a lot about the Minnesota public school system, but they apparently have some of the same challenges that many urban school districts around the country have. Like in other states, there's an ongoing debate about the optimal tax rates and whether people are being taxed too much. You know, the business community has complained about that for a long time. But I mean, if you look overall, Minnesota has been ranks as the top state in terms of college preparedness of any state in the country, according to the ACT folks. They have one of the highest rates, or one of the highest educational attainment rates in the country in terms of people with bachelor's degrees or above, and they've been the metro area, the Minneapolis-St. Paul metro area has been a magnet for young talent. So they seem to be doing an awful lot right.
Would a similar comparison to another state, let's say Illinois, where taxation is also really high in a lot of areas, would you expect a similar study looking at Illinois to yield strikingly different results? I mean, Illinois faces challenges that Minnesota doesn't, and higher taxes there have arguably had a lot less impact, correct?
A lot less impact in Illinois, positive impact?
Yes.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I mean, we didn't spend a whole lot of time looking at Illinois. I mean, the purpose of the report was to compare Minnesota and Michigan. I think some of Illinois' problems have been more recent in terms of, you know, they've had a lot of government corruption, you know, with governors going to jail, and they've got this big pension problem, pension funding problem that Minnesota doesn't have. So I think that's created some problems there. I think the thing to keep in mind about Minnesota is that this strategy that they've had goes back 40 or 50 years, and they've pretty much stuck to it through various administrations, whether it's been a Republican governor or a Democratic governor.
That's what I find interesting.
Independent like Jesse Ventura.
Sure. I mean, there have been notable conservatives that have emerged from Minnesota, and you're saying it doesn't appear to have changed dramatically, even when the GOP, for example, has enjoyed more political leverage.
Yes, that's right. That's right. You know, and as Lou Glaser at Michigan Future says, you know, if Michigan just simply tomorrow enacted all of Minnesota's tax and spending policies, I mean, you wouldn't necessarily expect Michigan to have the same results. And we're kind of careful not to say that this is, you know, there's exact causation there, but you know, it's something that they've done over the long haul, which appears to be paying off.
Rick Haglund is a longtime Michigan journalist and author of the report State Policies Matter: How Minnesota's Tax, Spending, and Social Policies Help It Achieve the Best Economy Among Great Lakes States, which was commissioned by Michigan Future Incorporated, an Ann Arbor-based think tank that focuses on the Michigan economy. Rick, many thanks.
You're welcome. It's good to be with you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Summer Solstice Jazz Festival takes place in East Lansing Friday and Saturday. A number of us from WKAR will be participating from the main stage there. And current state's Melissa Benmark's been checking out the festival as well. Actually, you'll be there Saturday afternoon, right?
I will. Okay. I'll be hanging out, I believe, with the Diego Rivera Band and Sonny Wilkinson, I believe.
Very good. So. And I relieve you at 7:30.
Okay. So you get the main stage event of the night there.
That's right.
Well, there will be jazz downtown, of course, from a variety of groups with the Solstice Festival. This year, the Broad Art Museum is participating with quite a unique event, a cosmic picnic with a lot of K's, in the museum's sculpture garden will feature Detroit's Planet D Nonet, which is going to be playing a tribute to the late Sun Ra, who celebrated, well, it is the late Sun Ra, but his 100th anniversary would have been this year. That starts at 1 o'clock on Saturday, and I got a chance to talk to the leader of Planet D, R.J. Spangler, who's been part of the Detroit jazz scene for many, many years.
I am a drummer and percussionist, band leader and producer, and I've managed singers over the years as well. So I've been in the music business for quite a long time. I've traveled throughout the United States, Canada, and Europe playing the drums. So I've seen the world from the back of a van. I started many years ago in a band called the Sun Messengers, and we played New Orleans music and world music and jazz and swing. And I spent quite a few years managing and drumming and running a band for a great blues guitar player named Johnny Bassett, which really took me around the world. And then I was with a woman named Alberta Adams, who's 97 this year.
Wow.
And she's not really up performing as much as she used to, but I have been her manager and band leader drummer for over 20 years now.
Wow.
Yeah, she was a young 77-year-old when we first hooked up, or 75, I think. Anyway, yeah, and I had a great run with a whole lot of different R&B and blues singers, 50s-era guys, you know, mm-hmm. and women, too. And that I traveled a lot doing that. Like I said, I started with a band called the Sun Messengers, which is a large group with a horn section and so forth, and we... Part of what we did was swing music, And we also did Sun Ra music too.
Well, I wondered if the Sun Messengers. I wondered if the Sun Messengers thing had anything to do with Sun Ra. Yeah.
Yes, and we did all of that, so as I've come kind of 360 in my career, I'm still playing with some of the guys I started with. I did a lot of things in my career. I covered a lot of ground. I played soul music, and jazz, and blues, and 50s R&B. And I came to the point where there's things that we started years ago that I just don't think I finished. So I'm working on them again. And so that's the Planet D. And the Planet D, we 90% of the time, we're playing great swing music by from the 20s into the 30s, early swing, you know, coming out of hot jazz, speakeasy era, you know, into the solid swing era. So we're doing Fletcher Henderson charts and Duke Ellington charts and stuff like that. And then that's 90% of the gigs that we play. And then the other 10% we split between doing gigs of the music of the great Sun Ra, and we also do charts by South African bands like Hugh Masekela, Abdullah Ibrahim, and the Brotherhood of Breath, who maybe you've not heard of, but no. A fantastic blue group.
So how did Sun Ra get into all this? That's pretty different from the other things that you mentioned.
Well, like I said, I've covered a lot. You know, I lived in that 3% of music that is jazz and blues my entire life, and I've covered every base within it. There's a lot of diversity. You know, you put 100 people in a room that say they like jazz, you're going to have 25 factions in a minute, you know. We started digging Sun Ra in the 70s when we were pretty young kids, young men, and he inspired us. I remember the first time I saw him afterwards, we went to a party at a friend's house. I mean, a party, it was, you know, maybe 15 people at most. Just a little get-together of people into this crazy music that we liked. And some of the guys from the Sun Ra band showed up.
Really?
Yes. So right away, we had a real connection, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, it was very tangible. And then right around the same time, back in Detroit, I met a bass player who was maybe a year older than I am, but he had already been on the road with Sun Ra himself and
wow.
Daryl Saunders and played some gigs with my uncle where they backed up Mose Allison. That guy's name was Shuby Doo. That's what he called himself. Reginald Fields was his actual name. And Shuby kind of took us under our wing because he was just a little older than us, but he had already done a lot, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he had played with Sun Ra. So he introduced us to other guys around the Detroit area who played with Sun Ra. So, you know, you understand what I'm saying? We started learning the cosmic lore of the music and meeting these guys, and they'd come through town, and we would hang with them. So it culminated in one year where one of the trumpeters from the band, Michael Ray, who guests on our latest Sun Ra tribute CD, he came and lived with us and played with us for a better part of a year.
So my understanding is that he was primarily a keyboardist, although, you know, lots more than that. But and you're
and
a drummer and a composer, and you're a drummer, and you must notice a difference in the way the music comes together when the leader is, for instance, a rhythm section player, or when the leader is a keyboard player, or the leader is a vocalist. What did you think he brought to his music from his keyboard background?
See, he's like me. See, look, there's this collection that came out of stuff that he had done in his lifetime, and he's on Wynonie Harris records. And I don't think I get the Wynonie, but he was a 40s into the 50s R&B singer, blues R&B singer, blues shouter in the Southwest. So Sun Ra did those type of sessions. He played with the Fletcher Henderson band. I played with Fletcher Henderson all the time. He played them in his group, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So he had swing, he had doo-wop, he had blues. I saw Sun Ra one time play a gig where he had the whole band lay out, and just him, the drummer, and Pat Patrick on alto played about 40 minutes of boogie woogie and blues, just the three of them, the whole band just in there watching, you know? So Ra came out of that whole thing like me, like, you know, learning the whole music business.
So you're going to be doing this picnic at the Broad Museum in East Lansing, and there will be people who are not familiar with the music of Sun Ra. What would you tell someone who's a first-time listener to help them kind of understand what it is that, in your mind, makes Sun Ra's music worth playing?
Well, he covers a lot of ground in his music. He was a great composer, and bring an open mind, and it's celestial. And it's beautiful, and it's earthy at the same time. All those components are there. Blues, swing, you know, sometimes odd-metered modal tunes, avant-free jazz. It's all in there.
When was the last time you saw Sun Ra?
Oh, I had quite a few years. He's been dead for a number of years now. But this is, you know, this is his centennial year.
Right.
He was born 100 years ago.
Right.
Yeah, but I've seen the band without him.
Mm-hmm. They carried on after him.
Yeah, I've seen them, you know, yeah, sure.
So,
still kicking it. They sound great.
So what's your next project, Sun Ra related or otherwise?
We have a brand new CD out. And it's called Just a Settin' and a Rockin', featuring John T-Bone Paxton. And John is our trombone player. And like I said, we've been making music together since 1978. And John sings and plays the trombone. And we do a number of Duke Ellington and Strayhorn tunes. We do some New Orleans music, you know, and we do a Percy Mayfield tune. You know, we just cover it all, and it's a small amount of tunes.
Well, R.J. Spangler, thank you so much for talking, and we appreciate your time today.
Oh, happy to do it.
Break a leg at the concert.
All right. Thank you very much.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Email us anytime at currentstate@wkar.org. You can email us about anything as well. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. I'm at Mark Bayshore. Juneteenth is a celebration marking the anniversary of the ending of slavery in America. In Lansing, the Juneteenth Freedom Festival is in its 21st year. The city and state of Michigan's Capitol kickoff will be at 5:30 p.m. today in the lobby of Lansing City Hall, to be followed by 2 days of activities in St. Joseph Park. There will be music, exhibits, head wrap demonstrations, a tribute to Negro League baseball, and more on Friday and Saturday. The keynote speaker at today's City Hall kickoff is Dr. Eugene Kane. Dr. Kane, superintendent of Lansing's Shabazz Public School Academy, and he is here to tell us about his school and his Juneteenth message. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Let's start with a look at Shabazz Public School Academy. How long have you been around now?
We're just closing our 19th year. We're going into our 20th year next year.
And what was the idea of the school's founders?
Well, I wasn't around, wasn't involved in it at the time, but, you know, Malcolm X grew up here in Lansing, and one of the things that they wanted to do was to pay tribute to Malcolm X, and they wanted a school named in his honor. And I think that, coupled with the fact that a community group called the Black Parent Support Network was concerned largely about the academic behavior academic results of African-American children, and felt that charter schools would perhaps open some new ideas to address this particular problem.
What grades do you teach at El Shabazz?
We have kindergarten through sixth grade.
And your enrollment right now is about what?
Pretty close to 300, around 300.
And the school provides an Afrocentric curriculum. Can you describe it for us?
Oh, I'd be happy to. We use the expression Afrocentric to say that at the epicenter of everything we do, it's about the history, culture, and experiences of people of African descent. Whether we are doing research papers, let me give you an example, a good example, because
sure,
this one is on my mind. Our sixth graders are required to read the autobiography of Malcolm X.
Mm-hmm.
You don't depart from the skills that are expected for your school, for your children, but you make sure that places where you can input the experiences and culture of people of African descent, you place it in the curriculum. We also have on a monthly basis, the fourth Friday of the month, we have Harambe. Harambe is East African expression, Swahili. That means coming together. And we come together around our kids. And we bring parents, we bring community members, of course, the students, the staff. And we talk about issues that are pertinent to our students, relative to things like staying in school, the importance of homework, how to help your child with homework, bringing in various cultural groups to perform, and various personalities to speak.
The autobiography of Malcolm X strikes me as a fairly challenging read for a sixth grader.
It is.
Do the kids respond to it? Or do they struggle with it? What do they take away?
I think some struggle, but we sort of piecemeal that to them. We augment the book with film, the movie. There's a ton of information on YouTube about these experiences. This year, we were fortunate to bring in his great nephew, who spoke of the family. Years ago, my second or third year, we had his younger sister at the time, Yvonne. She came and spoke. As a matter of fact, she did this for 2 years in a row. So we try to keep that connection with his family.
We're talking with Dr. Eugene Kane, superintendent of Lansing's Shabazz Public School Academy, about the Shabazz School and about his Juneteenth message later today in Lansing. What do you say to people who ask you about whether the Afrocentric piece comes at the expense of reading, writing, arithmetic?
Oh, you know, that one always comes up. One of the things that you will see in our advertisements is that we say that we emphasize the basics. And I think that has attracted people to us. And the basics basically are your social studies, science, math, reading, literacy, and so forth. We don't abandon those. There are things that you can do. For example, if you came into our building, the first thing you're going to be struck by is that, hey, this doesn't look like a school, because it's loaded with information that will keep you reading, perhaps for hours, about the experiences of people of African descent. It's also, there's a lot of art. There are sculptures from Africa and so forth. In other words, it's a living museum and a school. I always say Shabazz is not a school, it's an experience.
Mm. Tell us about the school's demographics. Is it exclusively African American?
We have largely an African American base population. We do have several students from immigrant students from Africa, from Yemen, from the Sudan, Uganda, and also from Liberia.
Describe your faculty and your staff for us.
Well, I have a wonderful faculty and staff. I have to put them all together. We say that we are a family, and we try to behave as such. They are largely from Michigan. It's about a 50-50 black-white makeup. I would say about half of them have master's degrees, and they're dedicated. They go beyond the call of duty.
I think there's still a fair amount of confusion as to how public school academies or charter schools are funded. I mean, you do receive state money, but what other funding comes into play?
We receive largely state and federal money. We have not been as successful as we would like as far as private grants, although we have in the past received a couple of grants.
And how have your graduates tended to fare? You've been at this 19 years. You can track a lot of your graduates, I would imagine, after they leave Shabazz. Do you track their progress?
We have not developed the tools to track our students. That's one of our number one items this year. We know that a number of schools, especially Lansing schools, they will tell you, we love the kids from Shabazz Public School Academy. We know that a number of our kids come back, especially for Harambe. And one of the first things we ask them, how are you doing in school? And so far, so good. But we need to come up with a scientific method of tracking our kids. They go everywhere, not only in Lansing, but Holt, Okemos, and a number of them out of state.
Eugene Kane is our guest here on Current State. He is the superintendent of Shabazz Public School Academy and a key participant in Lansing's Juneteenth observance here coming up later today. Defenders of charter schools say they provide choice for families and can be especially beneficial to minorities. Others criticize them as being too profit-driven, that they threaten the existence of public schools. What do you make of that debate?
Well, sometimes I chuckle because we're self-managed. We do not have a management company. We do it all. I do it all. I do everything from making...
You're the CEO of Shabazz
Academy.
Right,
and also you mop the floor, you know, do all those things. So those folks who say that, we say, pardon me, we are self-managed. We are not a profit-making organization, nor are we a tool of a profit-making organization.
Could you give us a preview of what you're going to say later today at the Juneteenth kickoff event at City Hall?
Be happy to.
What's your take on Juneteenth?
Well, you know, my first encounter with the whole notion of Juneteenth was when I was in elementary school in Birmingham, Alabama. We had to read the Negro History Bulletin, and we had to subscribe to that. I think it was something like 25 cents a month. And that was a publication of the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History. And that was the first time that I had encountered that. But in the local community in Western Birmingham, they celebrated it, although it was on a low level. And it's interesting that the planners of this is including baseball, because baseball was a big event for us in Western Birmingham at the time. But for your audience, Juneteenth is simply slaves of Galveston, Texas. They found out about their so-called freedom 2 years after President Lincoln had issued the Emancipation Proclamation, January 1, 1863. So they don't get it until June 19th. 1865, which is also a few months after the president's death, and after the president's death, and a few months after the end of the Civil War.
And it's because Galveston, Texas, was the epicenter, really, of this. That's where it took place. Is there a regional difference in terms of, it's more widely celebrated in the South than in the North?
Oh, yeah, this is big in the South, especially the Southwest. I found myself in Dallas about, pretty close to 20 years ago, and I was in attending a national conference, and events were going on, and one of the hosts invited me to join her family, and I really got the full-blown exposure to it.
You taught extensively in Detroit at the junior high and the high school level, Cooley High School, I understand.
Right.
And I understand you follow the fortunes of the Education Achievement Authority to
yes.
some extent. What do you make of the EAA?
Well, when they first came on the scene, I was puzzled as to why is it that this innovative operation chose 15 schools. I thought that was a big bite to chew. I thought that they should have gone smaller. I also was concerned at the makeup of the staff. A lot of the head folks were out of state. I just knew that they would get some Detroit people. There are a lot of resources right there in the city of Detroit, former school teachers, former administrators who could have been of big help to them.
Very good. Dr. Eugene Kane is superintendent of Shabazz Academy. We've been talking about his school, and we've been talking about Juneteenth here in Lansing. Nice to meet you. Thanks for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. A popular East Lansing park is in the midst of a major transformation. All week, dozens of volunteers have been hammering, lifting, and drilling sections of what will become a new playground at Patriarch Park. They're expecting to wrap up work today, and Current State's Kevin Lavery has been following their progress. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Mark.
And all this activity is triggered by a new play structure there, correct?
Yes. Many people in East Lansing who visited Patriarch Park remember the elaborate wooden playground that was built in 1995. It was made out of pressure-treated wood that was legal at the time, but has since been deemed a health hazard. Nobody was ever hurt because of it, but the East Lansing Rotary Club and others decided to raise money to build a new playground. On Tuesday, I visited the site, and the first person I met was Tim McCaffrey. He's the director of Parks and Recreation for the city of East Lansing, and he told me about the old playground that's since been torn down.
Yeah, the wood structure was a great community build project. In fact, in 1995, it was another joint project between the city of East Lansing and the Rotary Club of East Lansing. But the wood that was in the project was deteriorating. And on top of that, the wood was CCA-treated lumber, and the A in CCA stands for arsenic, you know, which is a known carcinogen. So, you know, you can do some things to make the problem not as bad. But what we decided to do was just, because of the deterioration of the structure, we just decided to say, let's go right from the start and start all over again and build a brand new structure.
This is day two of a four-day build. What was your turnout like yesterday, and provided the weather cooperates, what you may expect for the duration of the project?
We have, I believe we had about 50 volunteers yesterday out here. We have close to 50 again today. And if the weather cooperates with us, it's our expectation that the community build will be completed Thursday afternoon. If it doesn't cooperate, we'll have to go again on Friday. And we've got contingencies in place with additional volunteers. When it's all said and done, we're going to end up with probably 340 or 350 volunteers throughout the course of the week. So we're really excited about that.
What will this magnificent project look like when it's finished?
You're going to see a playground structure that spans, you know, several thousand square feet with a poured-in-place surface material. Although there's a number of playground structures in the area that have poured-in-place surface material, I don't think there's really any in the area that has, it'll have the size of the surface or the mass of the surface that this particular project will have. And then on top of that, we've got a rain garden project that we're putting in the north end of the property. We're going to capture all the rain. We're going to have three or four landscaping beds throughout the project. We're going to have a nice entry plaza with a pergola and some walkways leading you to the site. So I think folks will have the opportunity to be impressed when they come out and see the scope of the project.
When we're team lifting, we're going to use our legs. If I see you bent over, I will come and I will kick you in the butt. Is there anything else before I hand this over and we go work? Go.
All right, everybody come out here, let's go.
I'm Rich Sinclair with Sinclair Recreation. I'm the owner.
I heard some of your safety lecture a few minutes ago, and you're not kidding, because this looks like a minefield. There are a series of holes that have punctured the ground. Each of them are at least 3 feet deep, and they're everywhere.
There are. And we've got over 125 holes throughout the pit, Kevin. So volunteer safety is key. We want to make sure that no one gets hurt, that they continue to stay and work. And our job is not just to make sure the playground gets built correctly using the volunteer labor, but also to make sure that the volunteers have a good time and are glad that they've come out and volunteered their time and efforts to help do this for their community.
How's it shaping up so far? I'm seeing a lot of red or burgundy colored metal poles that will become the framework for things like jungle gyms, and there's a very large swing set over here. What's our status at this point?
Right now we're running ahead of schedule, don't tell anybody. We want them to keep working hard, but we've got two sets of concrete pours that we're going to do today. We're going to do one at midday. We have some pieces that need a little more time to get set up, so we're going to pour those at noon. And then, depending on what the weather does for us and how hard our volunteers work, we'll determine how much of the large ADA ramped structure, which is kind of the big piece that people will be able to see, will be able to be poured this afternoon as well.
What do you think of the civilians who have volunteered for this Army?
We can't do it without them. I've got 10 people here, but if just the 10 of us were doing it, even though this is all we do, it would take us weeks. So, it's a great way to engender a spirit of volunteerism. We encourage people to bring their children, senior citizens, people of all different abilities and experiences, and we try to engage each one of them with the skill set and experience level that they have. Volunteerism is a dying art, and projects like these are a great way to rekindle that within a community.
I see your name is Mario. Mario, what's your last name?
McLean. I'm from Detroit, Michigan.
And what do you think so far?
It's looking nice. It's good to see everybody out here working together for the greater sense of the community. And I'm proud to be a part of this project.
What have you been working on so far this morning?
So far, we've been working on the swings, just digging the right holes, making sure everything is aligned correctly. So that's what we're trying to finish up today.
Half the battle is not standing in a hole.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot of holes out here, but just got to be careful, be safe at all times.
I'm Linda Emery from Kohl's. We are assembling swings for the swing set, and we've been out here for an hour or so. I think it's a really cool project. I can't wait to bring kids out here. I got to get some kids, though, because mine are too big, but I can't wait to come back and play.
So they're too big for the swings?
Yeah, but I have some nieces and nephews I might have to bring over.
What will that feel like when you tell your nieces and nephews that you helped build this? Are they going to believe you?
They probably will believe me, but my children will warn them that if mom built it, you might not want to go on that one. I'm glad there's professionals here to check our work.
Spencer Cheek, and I'm the Senior Vice President and General Manager at Game Time.
And that's based in Alabama?
Correct, Fort Payne, Alabama.
Welcome to the North.
Thank you.
It's a little cooler up here. Tell me how your company builds projects like this and manufactures projects like this.
It is a completely make-to-order process. So we will actually take an order and then we'll start from scratch. We'll take the tube, we'll weld, we'll bend, we'll paint. We actually have 4 rotomold plastic machines where we'll mold the plastic, we'll coat the decks, everything soup to nuts, fully integrated process.
This is replacing a nearly 20-year-old wood infrastructure system that was laden with CCA-treated wood. Your thoughts on putting a much safer product up here in its place?
It's a long time coming. We're just proud that we could be a part of it. This system will be here for 20 years as well. So we look forward to having this for the community for many years to come.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, live jazz from the Marshall Music Jazz Lunch Series, that and lots more. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.